Willkommen bei Fahrradio mit dem zweiten Teil unserer Eurobike-Berichte von 2016. Thomas hat mit Tom Ritchie gesprochen, einem der Pioniere des Mountainbikes. Der hat zusammen mit Gary Fisher und Joe Breeze Ende der 1970er das Mountainbike erfunden. Das ist natürlich etwas vereinfacht dargestellt. Thomas spricht mit ihm über Radfahren, Rahmenbau und die Fahrradindustrie. Die Qualität der Aufnahme ist nicht so gut, aber inhaltlich werden alle Liebhaber der Fahrradgeschichte auf ihre Kosten kommen. Also los, Thomas!
Tom Ritchie is now with me outside Sunny Weather, the Eurobike Show 2016. And I can imagine that it is your 25th show too?
Yeah, sorry to believe.
Unbelievable,
huh? Yeah, I first started in Cologne here. So, and then a couple of other shows in Milan. So it's been, you know, even more than that as far as attending a show in Europe. But the Friedrichshafen show has definitely turned out to be the best show for many reasons.
Yeah. Oh, it's really because I attended the first show too. I've been on any, meanwhile, so any of the 25 shows. And it's impressive, and it doesn't seem like 25 years.
Yeah.
But you're in business even longer.
Yeah. The story of my company is probably, you know, not known to a lot of people because it's people think of my brand and think of me from the mountain bike point of view. But really, 10 years almost before mountain bikes got going, I was a young road cyclist building my own frames. So at 15 years old, I built and raced my own bike back in 1972, and it was many years of racing and building for others, and actually building quite a few components during those early years to race on that prepared me to be at the right place and right time. When the sport was in its infancy, and I was very much involved with the racing side of road bikes, national team on the world's team, and the performance of the bike was always important to me. There was people that I knew that were using ballooners and clunkers and bikes like this that were before I built my first bike, and of course I knew about them, and because it was a small world in the Bay Area, only, you know, 50, 60, an hour drive to Marin, an hour drive to San Jose, to Morgan Hill, and so the culture was an enthusiast culture. We were both both from a racing side, being kind of the epicenter of racing in the United States in the Bay Area at that time, but it was also the beginning of the business side. There were other companies, of course. Specialized was there, and Avocet, and Palo Bike Shop, and my company.
Did you ever buy a bike?
Ever buy a bike?
Yeah.
Yes, I bought a Raleigh Super Corsa when I was 11 years old from Sid Jocelyn at Jocelyn Bike Shop. I didn't buy it, actually. My dad taught me how to repair tubular tires, and at 11 years old, I was good at it, and the local bike shop needed somebody to do that job because they didn't have that skill, and there was, of course, it was the world of tubulars.
Yeah.
And so I came to Sid and I said, if I repaired tubulars for you at a certain price, could you barter for that Raleigh Supercourse? And he said yes, and I ended up, you know, taking delivery about 3 months later. And that was the first bike I bought. And that was pretty much the only new bike I ever bought.
Yeah, if you're a frame builder, you probably would change anything on any bike.
My story of frame building is a little bit more than just building my first frame. I couldn't afford anything, and it really the idea of building a frame wasn't when I was, you know, 11 years old. The idea of buying a nice bike, of course, was in my plans, but I could only afford a broken Cinelli.
Okay.
And so in order to ride the broken Cinelli, I had to repair the broken Cinelli. And it was a seat stay brake, and so I got a very good price on it. It was like $50. And I repaired the seat stay, and I realized in the repairing of the bike, in the frame repair, that I was looking at other things. I was looking at the building of a bike possibly in the future. But what happened is that other people realized that I repaired a bike. They wanted their bike repaired. So I went from repairing a seat stay to replacing a down tube to repairing a chain stay in a very condensed period of time. And as I took these English bikes and these Italian bikes apart, I realized that the quality was so poor that I didn't want one of these bikes anymore. I wanted to build one myself.
So the dreams vanished? So a Cinelli wasn't a dream bike anymore, but
when I had to take the bike apart, I realized it was you know, very poorly constructed, and even though the outside looked very nice, the inside was not that nice. And one of the influencers in my life, a guy named Joops Brandt, always went to Cinelli every year or every year or two, and he ordered a bike, and Chino made the bike personally for him. The picture of him taking delivery is on my company website. But he never trusted me in the very beginning because I was 15 years old, building my own bikes. He was a German engineer, worked for Porsche in the early years, designing the 911 braking system. Was very like, blah, 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 you know, Richie, do this, do this, do this, you know, kind of very autocratic. And not to make fun of your nature, but to me, that's, you know, that's how he was to me, especially at 15 years old. And it took me, he was a strong rider, and he broke parts. That was his reputation. So he would break things that no one would break, including his bike. And so he broke his, you know, his chain stay. He broke his fork. He broke his down. He broke his seat stay. And in 3 years' time, he was coming to me, and I was repairing his Cinelli. And by the time he, you know, in 3 or 4 years, half of the bike was a Richie anyway. And then he finally said, oh, okay, you build me one.
Okay.
So it was, anyway, at that point, the story for Joops is kind of my another story, but as far as me building in the very beginning, I learned building from taking other bikes and repairing other bikes, taking them apart. And I, you know, between the age of 11 and 14, 15, so there was quite a bit of you know, kind of, you know, doing all kinds of things with my father and my father's help. That made it not that difficult for me to say, hey, I want to build a bike. And at 15 years old, I found a guy that was a very obscure frame builder in the Bay Area that was in my neighborhood that had tubing, that sold me enough tubing to build a bike.
Yeah, cool. And you still do it. You still build frames.
Yeah.
Is that right that you're giving classes to?
No, I've only given a couple of classes to my son and friends, but I'm doing something in England in a couple of days.
Yeah, that's what I heard, but they are probably sold out.
Yeah, so you know, I am, you know, kind of toying with the idea that I would do this more in the future, and it coincides with a number of things. I'm reapproaching the bikes as a part of my product line and bringing them back with some changes, with some improvements. And as I do that, I think that you know, if you know my story as a component designer, some things don't happen for a long time. I have an idea of how to do something 40 years ago, and really it comes about that I do them when the materials and the idea and the manufacturer, the vendor, and all these pieces come together, and I realize it's possible to do something.
Okay, so you don't hustle.
I don't hustle a design. I've never hustled a design. I basically, you know, I'm not going to say, you know, I've always been the number one guinea pig, best guinea pig for all my products. So, you know, the thing that I think helps most people trust the Ritchie product is they know I'm a serious rider. They know I still race in some big races that are, you know, on the mountain bike side primarily. And they know I test my product and that I have a very close relationship with Thomas and a team and the best riders in the world.
Thomas Frischknecht.
Yes.
Still best buddies.
Yeah. So, you know, we are, you know, associated with the team side for 26 years now,
mm-hmm.
and many world champions and Olympic champions. And the relationship with Thomas is only better in terms of friendship plus product development kind of input. And so, you know, whether it's Thomas himself that really understands the bike better and knows what he's trying to do for his team, which is give them the best opportunities to win, or it's my closer association with the riders and riding with them and asking them questions and trying to find out, you know, what their needs are. There's a very authentic way in which I approach product development. And I, you know, I'm not going to be the first guy necessarily to do things, but when I get around to doing them, I think that I have a kind of a Shimano mindset where I'm not going to come out with something until it's right.
Okay, I've got to be honest, and I have to tell that to my listeners that I thought, okay, we met and said, okay, we make an interview, and I said, okay, I have to go to the Ritchie booth and have a look at the new parts, expected a stem or whatever, and then I see a complete lineup of beautiful bikes. I'm really impressed.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's been one of those things. I've continued to make the Breakaway, and the Breakaway was such a unique bike that was really all that I was offering until this year. But, of course, I wanted to make bikes. I wanted to you know, kind of, you know, put the effort into the bike line. But as, you know, I'm what I want to do and what I have time for and what the company and people that work with me, you know, want to do is often two different things.
Yeah.
And it really took this long for them to want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, actually a company has to exist, and its existence is like sell stuff. And
yeah.
So the market is right for steel bikes. I have to tell that most of the bikes are steel. There's one on carbon, no aluminum.
Yeah, the carbon bike is a Breakaway specific bike, and there will be another brother of that bike that'll be a cross one coming next year. So, you know, the Breakaway is kind of near and dear to me in terms of my lifestyle and what I want to, the quality of bike that I want to ride and use and travel. And I know that for a lot of people, it's the same story. So maybe not so much here in Europe, but back home. And having the top of the line bike that goes into a case has always been, you know, kind of my goal. And I consider the new carbon one pretty sweet bike.
Okay, so but this shows me that you don't have a dogma on steel.
Well, steel, you know, there's quite a few reasons that I did the carbon bike the way I did the carbon bike. First of all, carbon bikes these days are not, okay, let me back up. As a 15-year-old in 1972, the world of steel really hadn't changed for 50 years. you know, the construction methods and basically frame design. Yes, components had changed, but frame design was really pretty much a non-moving component. There wasn't a whole lot that was going on.
Horizontal top tube.
And diameters of tubes and budding constructions. And when I went to Columbus factory in 1984, they showed me on the wall the specification of Columbus SL tubing from 1898. And so as far as material goes and budding even, it was, there had been, you know, not a whole lot of new thought. Not that the quality of the steel was a problem, but new thought in buttings and diameters and geometry really was for the most part stagnant. And so as a person from 1972 that was looking at this, as a person that was surrounded by Silicon Valley tech engineers in terms of kind of the culture of engineers and people that were making big changes in the world that the world hadn't even attributed to them at that point. They were just engineers at that point. They weren't celebrated. The name Silicon Valley didn't even happen. Just like the name mountain bikes, they put me on the cover of Bicycling in 1981 and they called it backcountry cycling. I mean, in 1981, mountain bikes, the name still hadn't approached, you know, critical mass. So anyway, long story short, the way that the world looked at the bicycle was a steel bicycle. And it was a steel bicycle that had been there for quite some time, the way it had been there for quite some time. There is wonderful things that I can be thankful for that was a result of being born then at that period of time and building from that period of time. First of all, everything was measured from a steel platform, a material. You know, there was other materials. Of course, there was the, you know, all kinds of aircraft-grade aluminums. There was forgings, of course. There was companies, you know, CNC was not popular. There was no real CNC type machining going on at that time. There was, but it was in the real aerospace.
Yeah, it was,
you know, technology-driven industry.
Yeah. Technology.
But as far as any of the traditional, you know, components that were being made, they were made by general machining and forging and methodology. And so I say all this because steel was the measuring block of all things that work. And it was your fallback material for everything that you trusted. And so, you know, that a steel bike should last 10 or 20 years and be repairable and all those features was built into the way you thought as a person in the bike industry or a person trying to build frames or trying to improve the bike or whatever. It was like your benchmark was always steel. Steel, steel, steel. It still is. Your chain is steel. Your cables are steel. Your spokes are steel. Your axles are steel. Of course, all the very important parts that your bike wouldn't function in a predictable way are still steel. And in a very important way, people forget how much of their bike is steel. And so, of course, steel comes to you in the form of steel that goes to the moon and steel that's being made out of barbed wire and nails. And so the range that steel can be made is a unique range. Aluminum's much less of a range. Carbon, much less of a range. Titanium, much less of a range.
But carbon is the critical factor, meanwhile, when it comes to weight in a road bike, by the way.
Right.
They say, like,
anyway,
it's a very long
process of getting back to the breakaway being carbon.
Okay.
Okay? So the value that, at the point in which carbon started to enter the market, where the first bike was a Teledyne carbon bike that was from a company in Southern California that was an aerospace company making titanium parts and carbon parts.
I remember the Kestrel and all that stuff.
Anyway, during that mid-70s, there was new materials. Of course, people were, you know, playing around with titanium. They were playing around with aluminum. Elan was as a company, a French aluminum company. But the main thing that was part of my value set was, of course, measuring it against steel. How does it rate against steel? And what is the ride characteristic? So if the ride characteristic was what it was today, I don't think too many people would be interested in carbon fiber. Carbon fiber today is a material that has been pushed because of its lightweight and aerodynamic to a design and shape that is not truly as ride characteristic good as a steel bike. So if you look at the breakaway that I introduced, it's going back to 1972. It's going back to conventional diameters, what you need. You need a carbon fiber bike with conventional diameters, slightly oversized to steel, in order for you to have the ride characteristics that you want, that people are beginning to, beginning to appreciate in steel again. They don't know why, because their carbon bike was this, and either they bought it for $10,000 and it was this bike that was just an amazing bike that they got talked into buying because it was the fastest bike, or it was given to them, you know. And there's tremendous, difference between a racer in the 70s and a racer in 40 years later. It's the amount of free stuff that is given out that never was a part of the sport when I was racing. Maybe you had that in Europe, but there was no sponsorship of riders.
Okay.
A rider worked in a normal job, raced, in his spare time, trained in his spare time, afforded everything he practically had, repaired everything. So the rider was the whole thing. He was the whole team. I mean, as in terms of sponsorship, there was very few people that I knew that had even stipends, which was maybe a plane ticket, or maybe somebody was going to give him a bike. And I lived in that world, and I saw that, and I was on the edge of it before Le Mans came in, and things changed, and the pro side came in. But there's a big difference between a culture that is only knowing the sport from, very much a sponsorship side, and a lot of free, product that is being pushed by the marketing sides of a lot of companies that have developed over the last 40 years, and people buying their bikes.
But do you think that the time is right now that people like appreciate steel again, and the factor that or the fact that a bike should be comfortable?
A bike could be what?
Comfortable.
There's a lot. You have to start in the right place you have to start in the right kind of characteristics when you're talking about comfort. The spin game has been going on now for, 20 or 25 years in terms of big companies and marketing things. So there's comfort that comes from the design of a wheel, and of course the tires and all kinds of things. There's comfort that comes from the frame design. There's comfort that comes as a consequence of a lot of other factors, the saddle designs. I mean, the saddles were comfortable back then. They were designed for comfort. Saddles are designed for sex appeal now. They're designed for, you know, the look. The shoe industry took over the saddle industry, and it turned into fashion. And so, guess what happens? The clothing company now needs to put a half inch of padding in your clothing in order to ride, you know, the sexy looking saddle. So there's a lot of cause and effects and unintended consequences that has left a lot of people confused. They don't really know what comfort is anymore. They don't know why a steel bike is designed the way a steel bike is. They just, you know, there's probably 90% of the people looking at steel hearing rumors that it's comfortable, but not really understanding why. It's based on tubing diameters. It's based on, you know, a material that has a modulus elasticity that's different than other materials. There's a lot of engineering. The physics of a bike, you can do these calculations, you know, and if you take a beautiful steel bike that's very, very authentically, you know, dating back for comfort, let's say, for, you know, big tour rides or whatever, and you put a 60 millimeter or even a 38 millimeter deep section carbon rim on it, you're going to have a completely rigid bike.
Yeah.
Or it's not going to be as, you know, as much of a well thought out complete bike. But if you go back and you look at 32 spoke wheels, 36 spoke wheels, narrow section, tubular rims, all these other things that complemented basically the ride quality characteristics and the absorption of energy and still were fast and still were light, you can barely recreate that now. People will, I mean, there's still much more to discover in the comfort story.
Yeah, and one last question, probably, because the time's right for steel again and a well-thought-out bike, I think. Will there ever be an e-bike?
A what?
An e-bike at Tom Ritchie.
An e-bike? What's that?
Look, I understand.
Look,
yeah.
Here's the deal. I like going off into the woods. I like going off in the woods alone. I don't want to have to worry about my equipment. If I go off and I'm out of cell phone range and I have a mechanical problem, it better not be electrical, you know, because I'm going to be pissed. And so I got to stay with products that I know I can get myself out of trouble. It's not that electrical isn't a value in the city. It's just not me. It's just not who I am.
Yeah.
I'm gonna want to not worry about anything because I like to ride into deep unknown places or places that are going to be very difficult to get myself out if I have a mechanic. So I've got to be a mechanic. I've got to be, and a ride, that's the other thing, is mountain biking brought in the mindset of rider mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
That a rider has to ride within the limits of his own understanding of the bike. And that's how he wins. That's how Nino wins. He wins with all this, you know, training and incredible, you know, finesse. But he wins because he understands the limit of his bikes.
Das war der zweite Teil der Eurobike-Serie und vielleicht der erste Teil der inoffiziellen Serie Legenden der Fahrradgeschichte. Wenn ihr uns etwas Gutes tun wollt, dann bewertet uns bei iTunes. Wir freuen uns auch immer über Kommentare per E-Mail oder Twitter oder Facebook.